You're listening to Treasured Memories, researched and presented by Mary Curie, recorded and produced by Shirley O'Regan for West Limerick 102 FM. So we are here today with the second episode of Treasured Memories, and I suppose congratulations, Mary, initially on your very successful book launch. The book is out and available, and we can get our hot little hands on a copy.
Yes, certainly. It's available at Dooley Super Value in Newcastle West, and also at Hayes' newsagents in the Square, Newcastle West. And it's they're selling like hotcakes at the moment.
people are dying to get it.
Indeed.
If you'll pardon my terrible, terrible pun, I'll stop now.
Okay.
I will have no more puns. But no, it was a very successful launch, and it was lovely to see such a convivial gathering of like-minded individuals at it, wasn't it?
It was a lovely evening. Definitely, yeah. People from all the different heritage groups were there, and history societies and so on. So that was excellent. And even a few people from Newcastle West.
Yeah. But I think it was a lovely occasion where people who might not have caught up with each other in quite a while got to meet up and got to chat and mingle again. You know, there was a great sense of occasion about it.
That's true. And for those people who couldn't get to the launch, it's available now on YouTube, episode 504 in Newcastle West in olden times. So thanks to John Upton for putting that online and for editing it.
You see, that there's a great value, I suppose, in recording these things and archiving them. And I suppose that's what we're at here with the podcast as well, is we're looking at some of the stories from the book and some of the lives contained, you know, because as we said in the first episode, it's much, much more than a book about a graveyard. It is a book about the entirety of the history of the locality, if you like, and the people who shaped it as it is.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah. So today we're talking about men from Newcastle West who fought in battles abroad or for different armies. And some of them survived and came back to Newcastle. Others died on foreign fields, as they say. So the earliest ones we have are two that are connected, and they're fairly near each other in the graveyard, Stones 358 and 394. Both these men fought in the Napoleonic Wars, but on opposite sides, which is the tragedy, isn't it, of Ireland?
That's war.
Yeah. So Terence McMahon fought with Napoleon, and he distinguished himself in the field of battle. And he became colonel, first of all, and then he was made a knight of the Royal and Military Order of St. Louis. And he died at an elderly age, but in his 80s, in 1817. But he'd been right through the...
Isn't it extraordinary that he lived such a long, long life, you know, bearing in mind how eventful and tumultuous it was.
Yeah. So he died in Toulouse in France, in the south of France. But also he came from a notable family here in Newcastle West. His father, Terence, also McMahon, died in 1752, and he was 107 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
In 1752. That is beyond remarkable.
Yeah. There was a land surveyor in Newcastle West at the time, Joshua White, and he kept a diary, and in it he noted that Terence McMahon had died. The above old gentleman, who was of ye superior family, left a large offspring of children and grandchildren, and had a noted funeral. He was allowed to be the most remarkable son in this town, or part of ye country for this time. There you go. That was in his diary. So it's fairly accurate that he was 107 or 108 years old. Meanwhile, in the other grave, we've got Patrick Wolfe, and he served with the Royal Navy. He died in 1817 also. He was 42 years of age. There isn't anything about his army record, but he left a will. And in his will, he said that his dad was a cobbler, and he'd built two houses on Maiden Street, and he'd leaving those two houses to his sister, Honora Dalton.
So much more kind of mundane and homely, but still, you know, still the sense that, you know, the houses in Maiden Street, the sense that they're part of the town.
Indeed, yes. So it's nice, but it's kind of tragic, isn't it, at the same time, that you two Irishmen and they were fighting on opposite sides, and... You know,
history repeats itself again and again.
Yeah, and we find the same in the American Civil War, Irish soldiers on both sides. But the next person we have buried in Churchtown who fought abroad or was at a foreign battle was Dr. Bolster. And he was in the Crimean War and luckily survived and came back to Ireland and lived to a good age of about 81. Then we have another coming more to the present day, if you like. We had William Mackesy. He emigrated to America, and unfortunately World War I broke out while he was there. So he joined the US infantry and served and survived. And then he sent back to Newcastle, sent the money back, I guess. And four of his nieces and nephews joined him. And then his brother and his wife, Thomas and Sarah Mackesy from South Quay. Thomas was a tailor. They came with 10 more of their children. And there's a picture in the New York Times of Sarah with her 10 children. She's got a babe in her arms, and they're all the way up like little steps. And they're all really well turned out. You know, for immigrants, they look really well. And of course, because their dad's a tailor. I mean, it must have been a full-time job just
clothing his own family.
So they emigrated in 1926. But it was all down to really the fact that William had gone first and had earned the money, if you like, being in the army.
But isn't that a very typical Irish story of the time? You know, that the first immigrant is the person who is charged with the responsibility of bringing out the others.
Sending the money home and, but it's kind of tragic at the same time that all those people left. And
it's a huge family, like when you think of the children and
at least 14 emigrated. So I don't know if others stayed or what the full story is there. But it's nice to think now that their grandchildren might be coming back and visiting Newcastle and seeing the place, you know.
That's it.
We then come on to World War One from the Irish people who served with maybe the British Army. And the most amazing story is the Hart family. We've got three brothers joined. And fortunately, John Hart, he joined last, but his other two brothers are Patrick Hart. And Patrick unfortunately died in May 1915, and his other brother had predeceased him. So they both died within 9 days of each other.
Oh.
It's very sad.
We don't know.
Their parents were Eugene and Ellen Hart. And her maiden name was Singleton. And he was married to Mary Hart, Mary Dore. So that's Patrick Hart. At the same day that he died, Patrick's death was recorded in Father Gleason's diary. And 139 members of his battalion died on the same day. So it's
difficult for us to imagine the scale of the thing, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. When Patrick died then, his brother John felt that Patrick had made a commitment to that battalion, and he felt he should fill his shoes. So he joined. Now, this is the third son in the same family. I felt so sorry for their parents, the mother in particular. You know, you think two sons already dead, and the third one is joining up. But anyway, he was accompanied to the railway station by the Newcastle West Pipe Band. And some of the leading townsmen included Mr. Thomas Hurley, county councillor, Mr. R.K. Sheehy, auctioneer, Mr. Murphy, town council, Mr. A.J. Burns, clerk of the union, and Mr. J. Ryan and Magner all gathered there. And the town made a touching reference to Mr. Hart's capabilities as a commander and pointed out that every local volunteer parade, Commander Hart was sure to be taking a prize for the manor and company under his command. He carried out their manoeuvres, and he could boast of the best drilled company in West Limerick, having won three first classes and two second class prizes. John survived the war, thankfully. He lived to good age 71, and he's interred at Churchtown at Stone 129.
Well, it's lovely to have a happier ending to that story, isn't it? The third son did return.
Yes, thank heavens. Yeah, but I was just thinking of the stress on all the family, and I'm amazed that a pipe band accompanied him to the station.
The sense of response, a huge sense of responsibility as well.
Yes. This is all before 1916. This is early in the war.
The sense of responsibility to fill his brother's shoes and to come back.
And to come back, certainly. You know. Yes. Yeah. We had another family as well where three sons went, and unfortunately, none of the three survived, and that was the Pierce family. So James, Patrick, and Robert Pierce, and one of them died in Suvla and Cemetery, and he's buried in Suvla Cemetery in Turkey, so he was in Gallipoli. And the others were in active service in France, but irrespective of where they died, it's just tragic that three from the one family died. And I was talking to Mrs. Mullins in Ardour. She'd be grandniece of these, and she said she remembered as a child seeing the widow's penny up on the wall.
Oh, yes.
And this was sent to the families, and it was like a little commemorative little brass plaque, and the name would be inscribed around the edge with the date that they enlisted and died. So But she said that came down anyway when time has moved on, and it was kind of hidden away in a drawer, and I think it's kind of been lost now. But they would have been fairly commonplace, you know.
Oh yeah, I mean, as we say, when we think about the sheer numbers and the scale of the thing, like, there would be, unfortunately, no shortage of widow's pennies in houses throughout Ireland.
Yeah, it's kind of, it's tragic. I think the other tragic thing too is that, because of the way the War of Independence evolved and then the Civil War, people felt they couldn't talk about
these lads that had died. They couldn't give them the respect that was due to them.
That's right. So you didn't have these month mind masses, and you didn't have the annual anniversary masses, and you couldn't actually tell anyone. It was just such a closed environment. And such a negative anti-British feeling that you couldn't say your son had served or
anything.
And
when often the choice to serve was economic more than anything else.
Certainly. You can see that if you look at the 1911 census and you see there's a married man with maybe three or four children and maybe unemployed. And then the next thing, he's joined up. And he's obviously joined up to make money.
It's not out of any allegiance or lack of national pride. No. It is, in order to keep
economic.
His family alive. Yeah,
yeah, put bread on the table, certainly. You do see a difference between the men in the old IRA monument and the men who signed up. The majority of men who signed up were older, and a lot of them were married, about two-thirds were married. Whereas the IRA guys, well, of course, they weren't paid for a start. They were volunteers. But also, they all tend to be in their 20s.
In the 20s, young
men. Even
young
Sean Finn,
men.
20s. You know.
Sean Finn, 23 when
23,
he died.
23, a ridiculously early age. The same thing, you see,
and
Garrett McCall of 20s.
Accomplished so much in that space of time.
Such
like,
a short time, And it's just kind of frightening. You think Garrett McAuliffe, okay, it was exciting for him. He had a gun in his pocket and he was out and he was chasing people around, and doing all kinds of really interesting stuff. But you imagine the impact that had on the family and the girlfriends and the wives and the sisters and everyone else who was at home.
Even the people themselves. We've done, I was telling you before we came on here, we've done extensive programmes on the independence period. But, even the likes of Sean Hogan, there's a lot of research has been done on his life during the War of Independence, let's say after Salehead Beg, and the mental health issues that you would experience after that, and it's just very traumatic, even for the individuals themselves, to be constantly on the run, to be constantly in danger, to be injured and very frequently have only rudimentary medical care.
Absolutely.
Because you're still on the run.
Absolutely. And this is a time when medical care was rudimentary. There was no penicillin. There was, very little. I read a report there once from the dispensary in Limerick City, and it was on audio. And it's this woman saying, you got three things. You went in and you had your own bottle, and you weren't given anything unless you had a stopper for the bottle. And she said, you were either given something for lice, if you had lice, or something for your chest, and it was pink. And something for your tummy, and it was kind of a bluish colour. And that was it.
That was
the three medicines you got. And this is the 1950s she was talking about.
Yes. Whereas we're talking further back. We're talking about the 1920s and the late teens. And we're talking, I suppose, about, as I say, people who would be on the run, people who would not have the facility to go to a doctor or dispensary themselves. They would be sending others to get something that might help,
That's right, yeah. So really tough times. The last family I'm going to talk about there for World War One was the Sextons, and they had two sons who both served. James Sexton, he was in the postal section of the Royal Engineers, and John Sexton. They're both sons of John and Mary Sexton of Ballyconway, and they're both unfortunately killed in action. One in 1919, and both 1919. Oh, sorry, the second in 1915. That's right. Okay, and then moving on from the Sextons, the next soldier I'd like to talk about, he married a girl from Newcastle West, and he was actually Canadian himself.
Ah.
Okay, so this is on the Hart stone, and she was originally Hart from Newcastle West. And you remember, there are other family members, I think probably cousins of hers who had died. But she married a Canadian, and his name was Basil Halhead.
Wow, what a great name.
Great name. So she married him. They met, must have been home on leave a few times, and they had a home in London, and they had a daughter together. And then he went back to war, and this is a stage where the Canadians and the Americans have a joint operation and they've invaded Italy and they're pushing against Mussolini and moving north towards Rome. Unfortunately, in the way, they come across Monte Cassino. Now, they could quite easily have circled around Monte Cassino and left a small battalion or whatever there to take it and to keep the Germans occupied. But no, the general in charge said, I leave no one behind. I'm just going to push forward in a straight line and I will take Monte Cassino. And Monte Cassino...
We know how that went.
Yeah, it was a disaster, really was. It's just interesting, before Monte Cassino, when he arrived... they would have come in at the Bay of Naples and they would have seen Vesuvius. And Vesuvius hadn't erupted since, I think, 57 AD. So, no, people just saw it as a kind of a historic thing. They didn't really think of it as a volcano that could become active. And in 1942, unfortunately, it did become active.
And I mean, things weren't bad enough without that starting up again. You know, it's amazing when you think things can't get any worse. They can.
The unfortunate thing was, just about 12 miles from the base, the Americans had an air base and they had all their planes out there on the air, you know, in the airport. And when it erupted, they didn't think that they were in any danger. They thought, oh, well, it's 12 miles away. But what they hadn't seen was that the volcano erupted, all these lava balls went straight up in the air for a mile, and then when they came back down, the outside had hardened and the inside was still boiling lava.
Still molten, yeah.
So these droppers were called pyroclastic bombs, and they lost more planes on that day than in any other battle since. So they put a media blackout on it, because they were afraid it would lower morale.
Of course.
But of course, Hitler heard about it and he said, I've God on my side. Here's proof. It wiped out the Americans.
Yeah, well, isn't it? It is still striking that you can say what can possibly go wrong, and then, you know, a volcano will erupt.
Yeah, unbelievable, really. But that happened before Monte Cassino, and then under Monte Cassino. And unfortunately, Basil was one of those who died there, and he's buried there. But he is commemorated at Stone 757 with his wife, who died in 2006, aged 85.
So imagine to have lived such a long time without him.
Yes, he died in 1944 and he was only 24. Again,
the sense of potential as well as the loss, you know, is very touching, isn't it?
Yeah. So then, the Second World War, I imagine other people from Newcastle would have served in the Second World War, and hopefully they survived. But anyway, moving on then, again, we have people who joined and who served with the UN and served in the Congo.
Of course.
And from Arda, we had Mr. Gehagan, and unfortunately he died in the Congo. He's buried in a Thay. But moving on then, so the final war is the Vietnam War. And from Newcastle West, we have Patrick J. Singleton. First, he was son of Joseph Singleton and Margaret Lenehan. And he signed on, first of all, in England. And he joined a merchant marine ship, the Lembulus. And that sailed to Curacao in the West Indies and then on to New York. And then in New York, he crewed for about 2 years with another one, the British Cavalier, from 52 to 54. And then he stayed to Santa Cruz in Tenerife and on to Texas. And there he enlisted with the U.S. Navy, or the U.S. Army. And then he did two tours of service in Vietnam. So he really had a very fascinating career.
Amazing, amazing. And why don't we know more about him? You know,
I don't know.
He should have been writing memoirs. People should have been...
Yes, that would have been interesting, wouldn't it? He served there. He did a first tour of duty was 58 to 63. And then the second tour was 63 to 69. So it's the second time he's in Vietnam. I think 58 would maybe more like Korea. Is Korea still going on at that stage?
I think so.
Yeah. And he obviously does very well because he becomes a master sergeant of the U.S. Air Force.
Wow.
And he gets himself a Purple Heart.
Wow.
Wow.
So why don't we know more about him?
I would love to know more about him, but unfortunately.
You see, this is one of the purposes of this, as we do it as well, is to encourage people to ask people about their stories and record and document their stories.
Because
everybody thinks their own life is ordinary. You know, to everybody, their life is ordinary because it's their life. They've lived
it.
I mean, everybody has a unique story and a story that is worth recording, a story that is... But, you know, particularly, as I say, you know, how do we not know more about his Purple Heart? And, you know, why didn't he tell anybody?
I don't know. And he is buried here in Churchtown, 2001. You know, so it's reasonably recent.
It's reasonably recent. Yeah, and yeah. I suppose just reminds me of, as C.S. Lewis says, we meet no ordinary people in our lives. You know, everybody has a backstory. Everybody has...
Yeah. Maybe he's just a quiet guy who didn't want to talk about it. I think sometimes that happens. You know, if you're researching people from the War of Independence and you think, oh, I look up military bureau affairs, and you find that they haven't recorded anything. And I think some of them didn't record anything. I think for two reasons. One, because some of them felt it was a way they were making money out of the past, and that was wrong. Yes. And others felt they just didn't want to relive it. They saw gruesome stuff, and
yeah,
they really...
That it was compartmentalised, that was
right.
over, and this
that's
is
right.
now.
And I think things that went on in Vietnam were probably pretty horrible. There was at times a genocidal attitude to the whole thing. And I think some men just wanted to walk away from that and never go back or never revisit it. So maybe he didn't want to own it.
Yeah,
you know?
An extraordinary thing too, though, to walk back into ordinary life.
Yeah, and to be able to adjust and to become a committed person in society, that is difficult. Yeah, but I think the tragedy I found anyway in the earlier wars, the Napoleonic War, not probably Crimea, but in the American Civil War, is the fact that the Irish are on both sides.
That's
terrible. And a lot of Irish in Napoleon's army, he had a whole regiment for Irish.
Yeah,
it's amazing.
Yeah.
So it's not just one or two. It was,
The scale and the numbers.
The numbers are phenomenal. Yeah. So I think there are far more soldiers. I think there's something like 30 soldiers in all buried in there. A lot of them are British soldiers who came after the Napoleonic War, and they were stationed in Newcastle West. And unfortunately, the stones start off with their children's. So there are quite a few tombstones there and table tombs. And they're actually beautiful looking. And I think it's because when a child dies, you feel you want to put that extra effort into it. And they're beautifully designed. But they're nearly all are English names like Faulkner, Albertson, and so on.
Okay.
And they would have been stationed here in Newcastle after the Napoleonic Wars. So you get a whole variety of soldiers,
a sense of the overall social history as well, the social dynamics of the town at the time.
Absolutely, yeah. So I think also they contribute in a sense to the social life of the town. If you think having 200 there in barracks in Newcastle West, obviously they kept shoemakers going, and
overall economy of the town. You know, there were businesses that were run because these were here.
Anyway, when it gets to the Crimean War, the battalions pull out and they're all left and they don't come back again. So we don't actually have soldiers in Newcastle West.
And again, you must have had a sense of loss in terms of the local economy at that point.
On rare occasions, they do come back. So for specific events, so for example, the Glencharald evictions, they bring in a small regiment to deal with that. And again, obviously, 1914 to 1922, the soldiers come back again.
Yes.
And I think at some stage, Tom Toomey said there was about 2,000 soldiers billeted in Newcastle.
Yeah.
Unbelievable.
Again, just shocking numbers, when you think of the scale of the thing.
Yeah. And you think, at the time, the population itself was about 3,000.
Yeah, and you had 2,000 soldiers 2,000 keeping order on 3,000.
How did you move without falling over them?
it's just, as I say, this the book we're talking about and the project we're talking about is so much more than a book about a graveyard.
Indeed,
It's a book about the entire social history of the town and its inhabitants.
That's it, yes.
And I suppose that's where we will leave episode 2, and we will be back with you next week to talk about railway workers.
Railways, yes.
You have been listening to Treasured Memories, researched and presented by Mary Curie, recorded and produced by Shirley O'Regan for West Limerick 102 FM.